Okay, so let's begin with this actual talk about selfhood. You'll see, if you read Crosby, again, I'm going to go through it pretty closely, so if you can't read it, that's fine. You'll still get the main gist of things. He begins by looking at our moral experience and then at negative moral experience. That is to say, he wants to awaken in us a sense of selfhood by looking at examples in which selfhood is violated. This is called the negative way. Theologians are familiar with it, and many other people are too. It's just you often find that a thing stands out in a way. You become aware of it precisely at the moment when it is denied or ignored or trampled upon. So in order to get as wide a common audience, an audience as possible, Crosby begins with negative examples of a violation of personhood, and from which then afterwards he'll draw the various truths about selfhood. So the first example, to go through them one by one, is the example of the scapegoat. He talks, paints this idea of a racially mixed community in which a crime is committed by one race. The race of the criminal is known against a member of the other race. And the offended race wants revenge, and riots are about to break out, and unfortunately nobody knows who the criminal was, who did the act. And so the authorities come up with this idea of, let's just take this innocent man, maybe someone who has no family or whatever, this innocent man, frame him, condemn him, and punish him, and that way we will prevent the riots, we'll prevent a lot of harm and an injury to persons, property, and so on. Almost everyone will feel immediately that something's wrong there. This scapegoating of a person is not allowed, and it's not allowed precisely because we're dealing with a person. You could use a thing, you could even use an animal in this way, sacrifice an animal, even if you love it, even if it's a noble animal like a horse or a dog or a dolphin, for the sake of a great common good. But to sacrifice a person in this way, that most people will feel is wrong. Something serious. It's seriously wrong, and the question is, what does that reveal about the person? Why is it that we all instinctively, intuitively know that's wrong? The second example he uses is that of prostitution. Why is it that everyone feels, I think it's felt even by people who want to deny it in theory, that a prostitute degrades herself, typically? There may be very few exceptions. I mean, one that comes to mind from Dostoevsky's Pride and, Crime and Punishment, where a very noble lady still does a wrong thing by selling herself. Nevertheless, forget that. Typically, a prostitute degrades herself, and she is degraded by her clients. We all feel that. And notice that in this case, it's voluntary. Sometimes it's not voluntary, but let's assume that the prostitute thinks this is just a good way to make money. It's hard to make ends meet, and this is a way of doing it easily. And so she decides that's what she wants to do. This shows, then, that it's also possible to degrade oneself. You can violate your own personhood. That's different from the scapegoat example. And I think, although Crosby doesn't mention it, it also says a lot about the embodiment of the person, which we'll talk about much later, because you could describe prostitution as the selling of your body, the person using his body to make money. Why not use the body to make money the way you would use your house, say, or your car? All right, so prostitution is another example. A third example Crosby uses is that of breeding human beings in order to perfect the species. That, when he mentioned it, was perhaps more theoretical than it is now, when we have designer babies and genetic engineering, people advocating transhumanism, where the idea of a sort of set human nature is out of date and we should just try to improve human nature and so on. Why do we find that most of us still, even though I think there the consensus is dwindling, it's disappearing, why do we find that morally repugnant? What is it about that that seems to be so out of whack? Why aren't we proud of our ability to perfect human nature like that? Like I, as a Dutchman, am proud of the Holstein cows, the world's best producing milk cows, and the most handsome milk cows around, beautiful black and white, and you owe it all to us, my country. So I take pride in that, but I am not at all proud of the idea that Holland, as well as many other countries, are engineering human beings in the same way, specifically to get for couples that want smart babies or blonde girls or something like that. It seems to me that is morally reprehensible and something to bury about the Dutch rather than to tout. So we have a problem with this idea of it's not just that in this process many specimens, many of the embryos used will be destroyed. That, of course, is a problem. That's a crime in and of itself. But the very idea of looking at all these embryos as mere specimen, mere instances of a human race that we're trying to perfect. So Crosby points out, we are repelled even by the scientist who keeps the specimen for the sake of, because it's a perfect specimen. So there he doesn't commit a crime, he doesn't kill anything, but his reasons for keeping on and protecting and maybe spending a lot of money on this embryo are all wrong. They have to do with not so much with the person that's there, but with the type or the instantiation or the value that person has for the species. So you have a similar issue, not just in cases of breeding, but whenever an interest in types, say, or cases, overwhelms our attention to the individual at stake. Doctors often have this. I think it's a typical temptation for doctors, particularly those that are interested in the science, to get interested in the case, interested in the disease and trying to fix it, rather than the person who's suffering from the disease. So again, why do we feel that is a temptation? Why is it something to be resisted? What does that say about the human person? A fourth example is perhaps an obvious one, slavery, the owning, buying, and selling of persons. Everyone by now recognizes this as a serious wrong, as depersonalizing. Again, what is it about persons? We don't have qualms about cattle, people owning and selling cattle. And again, here Crosby makes an interesting point, namely that we even object to slavery if the slavery is good for the slaves. If the slaveholder takes care of his slaves, it treats them with kindness and so on, and lets them marry and gives them houses, whatever. The benevolent slave owner is much better, of course, than the cruel slave owner from a moral point of view, but nevertheless, we feel that there's something gravely wrong in the very idea of him owning these slaves and determining their fate. The fifth example is a less grievous case, but it's interesting. namely that we often, without doing anything, view other people as objects to be manipulated or obstacles in our way. I'll never forget Rhonda Chervin explaining it about her conversion. She said that prior to a conversion, other people were obstacles. Life was like an obstacle course, people to deal with getting in the way of her plans, or maybe useful for her plans, but nevertheless, sort of things that had to one way or another fit into her project. And it was only after her conversion that she's found, to her horror, what a awful way of looking at people this is. So, but I think that's a pretty dramatic example. But perhaps you, like myself, have discovered in a particular case maybe that you find to your chagrin that you have approached another person, viewed him as if he was not his own person living from his own center, but rather someone who just fits in your plans and is useful for the time being. What's interesting there is that very often people who discover this in themselves are very pained at it. They even though they haven't committed any crime, the other person may not be aware of what they've done. It's just an interior act that hasn't yet hurt anyone, at least in obvious ways. And yet, you feel sort of ashamed when you find that that's the attitude with which you have approached another person. I think it's a pretty common experience. I was just looking up Iris Murdoch, who says that, I'll read the quote, "Love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real." I think that applies especially to persons. It's very hard to realize that other persons are, as Newman says, infinite abysses of existence. They have their own concerns, their own views, their own perspectives, their own ends, their own longings, their own hopes, and so on. And to be aware of that throughout your day-to-day living is very, very hard. So five, again, it's less drastic perhaps, but therefore more common, and still, I think, very telling about the nature of persons. All right, so far we're staying very close to experience and paying attention to intuitions that we hopefully all share. As an aside, let me just say, this method presupposes something about our feelings, our sense, our intuition, namely that they carry meaning. They reveal something about reality to us. That's, I think, very often overlooked nowadays. I was reading the other day, a member signed up and he was involved with doctors and so on, and did an experiment on the way in which students, when they have to dissect human bodies for the first time, what effect that has on them. And she says, inevitably, in the beginning, they find it hard to do. There's something in them that has to be overcome. And some of them can't bring themselves to do it at all. And this person saw this as revealing something about the body, as containing some truth, some insight. But very often, this sort of thing is looked at as a mere hang-up, as some, you know, psychological issue that you have that's really irrational. It's as if they treat that sort of thing the same as, say, your tendency to faint when you give blood. That doesn't carry any meaning. That's best to just get out of the way. But these intuitions into things, this kind of deep repugnance to doing something, that is not just a blind feeling to be gotten over, but rather that it has an insight. I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind. And we should resist, I think, the arguments that say that's just a feeling. That's just, enough said, I think, to make that clear. All right, so what then are the four aspects of personhood of selfhood that Crosby gets from these, this four that he distinguishes. And these are ways of really stating the same thing, bringing out a different aspect of one and the same truth about the person. And the first statement he makes is this: persons are ends in themselves and never mere instrumental means. That is perhaps the most widely known description of personhood. It comes from Kant as very influential for good reasons, even though it has its problems and issues. Karl Wojtyła makes it his own while qualifying it. Crosby makes it his own similarly, and so on. So that phrase, persons are ends in themselves, never instrumental means, mere instrumental means. So we all have this sense, and this comes through in the scapegoat. What's wrong with the scapegoat, the treatment of the scapegoat? Well, he is being used. We don't like to deal with riots. We don't want to have to pay for all the damages, and therefore, let's just sacrifice this one person who nobody cares for anyway, and condemn him, punish him for the crime. Or in the prostitute, we typically say that the prostitute is being used by his or her client. So what this phrase, that persons are ends in themselves and never mere instrumental means, gets at is that persons are so, as Crosby puts it, strongly anchored in themselves that they can't just be ripped out from the center and used as a mere tool, as a mere means. They exist, and this is a phrase also occurring in Vatican II documents, they exist in some sense for their own sake. The documents speak about God creating persons as the only beings he has created for their own sake. So there is something about persons being an end point in reality that is being violated when they are being used as a mere, or viewed as a mere, means. In Wojtyła, this is not in Crosby, but Wojtyła's, Love and Responsibility, this truth is illumined by talking a little bit about the relation between persons and equality. Wojtyła says that whenever I use something for the sake of a certain end, then, of course, the tool, the means used, are subordinate to the end. I don't care for the hammer, I care for the building. I don't care for the glass, I care for the wine. So the means used to get the end are subordinate to the end. But then Wojtyła remarks, the means is also subordinated to the person who uses them. The person employs the means to get what he wants. So what happens when a person uses another person as a mere means? He subordinates that person to himself. So the equality of human persons presupposes this idea that one person can't be used by another. The whole idea of using another isn't just wrong, it also eliminates the footing of equality that persons enjoy in virtue of their personhood. Okay, there are all sorts of qualifications, of course. There are all sorts of ways in which we do use one another constantly.
And legitimately.
All right. I ask Katie to get me a cup of coffee, or I go to the store and I buy something, and I mean, I have nothing to do with the salesperson. I might not even like the salesperson. I might wish I had the other salesperson, and yet I go there and buy a piece of meat from that salesperson. I use his services. So that kind of using, obviously, is not an immoral kind of using. It's using perfectly compatible with the selfhood of that person. So we have to be careful and in qualifying exactly the kind of use. This is why Crosby says the person can never be used as a mere instrumental means, that we in some ways use each other's services, that is clear. But to completely forget, to completely overlook that the other person is a person, that he has ends of his own, that he must be willing to cooperate, right, with me. The other person must willingly sell me the meat, otherwise I'm using him. I often think of the difference between a salesperson and a Coke machine, which doesn't have to be willing to serve me the Coke. I can yell at it if it doesn't serve me the Coke quickly enough, and so on. Whereas the other person is a person, and I treat him differently by saying thank you, for instance. Crosby, under each of the points, makes another very important point, I think, and that is that these aspects, these truths about the person, are absolute. That is to say, they are true also in front of God. That's the way he usually puts it. Even God cannot and will not, especially God, will not use persons as mere means. He treats us as ends in ourselves. He has created us for our own sake. As the Vatican II documents say, or Aquinas says, he governs us for our own sakes, whereas animals are governed mainly for the sake of the species, and so on. So there are all sorts of ways in which, in the tradition, it's recognized that this this fact about the person, that he's an end in himself, not to be used, is absolute. It doesn't just hold for persons among each other, but also for God. All right, a second way of getting at the person is by saying this: persons are wholes of their own and never mere parts of a greater whole. Here again, the scapegoat example is a very obvious one. People will often say that the scapegoat, finding a scapegoat is justified. The officials who've done it will probably be the ones to talk like this, is justified because of the good of the larger community. The good of the whole required the sacrifice of this one member of the whole. When we reject that, we reject it precisely for this reason, that a person is never a mere part of a whole. He always exists, first of all, as a whole of his own, transcending any other whole of which he is in some ways also a part and a member. This is why utilitarianism, by the way, which is widespread in many ways and making lots of inroads in modern culture, is still pretty strenuously resisted, especially by people who've understood it a little bit. Why? Because for utilitarianism, the foundational principle is precisely that what matters is the greatest happiness for all. Not your happiness, the greatest happiness for all. And if the greatest happiness for all can be served by you being mistreated or even killed, that is what needs to be done. That's the morally right thing to do. So, of course, utilitarianists try to sort of weasel out of it, but in principle, they hold it, their principles imply it, as nobody shows as clearly as Peter Singer, who defends all sorts of horrible things based on that principle. So when we feel that this is not right, that a person cannot be sacrificed, we feel that he is his own center and can't find the meaning of himself, the center of himself, in the larger community. He has to find it in himself. Now, Crosby uses the analogy of an organ, which I think is very helpful. The relation between an organ and the body, in some ways, is used often to describe, even by St. Paul, to describe the way in which persons are related to the larger community, right? I forget, we are the toe and the nose, and every part has its function, and so on. But if you take the analogy, of course, is great. It's in Scripture. It's wonderful. But it has its limits. And the limit is precisely, one of the limits at least, is precisely here, that an organ can be sacrificed for the good of the whole. If I have some kind of disease in my legs that's going to spread unless I cut it off, I cut off the leg. That's not only reasonable, it may even be morally required. I may be a wimp if I don't cut off my leg in that case. So an organ exists for the sake, ultimately, of the body. It's a kind of independent thing. It has a function, a contribution to make to the body, but ultimately speaking, it can be sacrificed for the good of the whole. That is where a person is not related to the body the way an organ is to the physical body. This is clearly seen, I think, if you compare the diseased leg with the unborn baby. The diseased leg may be cut off and sacrificed, the unborn baby may not. Why? Because the unborn baby is a new individual, not a mere organ, not a mere part of the body of the mother. Of course, many people will disagree with that, but I'm not going to go into that. Okay, so here again, to be clear, you have to recognize that we are in some ways parts of a larger whole. We do fulfill a function. We are in some sense a cog in the wheel, and if we stop working, then the machinery will break down and so on. I think there's a very funny scene about that in Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, isn't there? There's
assembly line?
This assembly line where somehow or other something goes wrong over here and everything piles up at the end. So if one person doesn't fulfill his function, chaos ensues. And so we do fulfill a function. It's important. But maybe the way to put it is that a person can't be reduced to his function. He must always be aware, both himself and other persons around him must be aware, that he infinitely transcends the role that he plays in the larger whole. And as long as we recognize that and treat him accordingly, then we're fine. Here again, you can draw attention to the absoluteness of this, the metaphysical ultimacy of that truth, which is especially overlooked in pantheistic religions. Pantheistic religions, as Crosby puts it very well, elevate man in that they divinize him after death. You become part of the one great God. But on the other hand, they annihilate the person precisely because you don't continue to exist as an individual. You, as an individual self, cease to exist. It's only the stuff out of which you're made that becomes part of this great divine ocean. Right? So that, I think, is why most people would reject pantheism. Who cares what happens to my stuff? If I'm gone, it makes no difference. So there's clearly... This elevation of the self is really a mockery, because I'm no longer there to be elevated. Pantheism really violates the dignity of the person in a very profound way. Okay, a third way in which this truth can be described, shedding light on another aspect of it, is this. Persons are incommunicably their own and never mere specimen. That needs maybe some explanation, particularly the term incommunicable. Incommunicable has nothing to do with an inability to communicate, an inability to express yourself, such as I repeatedly suffer from. It has to do with the being of the person, that persons are their own being, and they don't share that being with anyone else. Of course, again, sharing needs to be qualified. Now, they have their own, you could say, metaphysical space, which they occupy and must occupy, and if they don't occupy it, nobody else will. All right, so there's this incommunicability about the person, and a person is never a mere specimen. This is what's especially clear in the breeding example, where individuals are valued mostly for the type or the species that they instantiate. All right. What the breeder fails to see is that what's really important about this individual is not the species, but his self, his individuality, the unique I that is present there. Another way of putting it, this incommunicability, is by saying that a person is unrepeatable, irreplaceable by another person. Strictly speaking, there is no duplicate of me. And the idea of there being a duplicate of me, that there are more beings out there that are I is horrific, or that I myself am not one unique person, but two. This idea of a split personality is also horrible to contemplate. So those are all ways in which you could sort of shed light on the importance of this fundamental sense that we are incommunicably our own and never mere stereotypes existing for the sake of some greater idea or species. Here again, utilitarianism goes clearly off kilter, off the rails. By the way, this contrast with utilitarianism is much more prominent in Wojtyła's explanation of all these truths. So that's one reason why it's worth reading in addition to Crosby's book. But utilitarianism thinks of persons as replaceable. It thinks of persons as nothing but pleasure-experiencing centers, you could say. What matters is not the center, it's the pleasure experience, the total amount of pleasure, or the total amount of happiness, as they say. That's what matters. But how many people experience it, or who exactly experiences it, that doesn't make any difference. I'll add online a quote by an animal rights activist with whom I disagree in all sorts of ways, but he has this deep insight into this truth, this problem in the utilitarianism that someone like Singer argues for. He says, Singer talks for animals ought to be treated correctly, but not on the basis of any value that animals would have. Animals have no values. Persons have no values. Utilitarianism doesn't recognize any intrinsic values. So it has all to do with pleasure, with experiencing happiness, sort of free-floating, untied, unconnected to the individual who is experiencing the pleasure. So there's a famous argument for infanticide that you may be familiar with that Peter Singer makes, which is precisely premised on this. He says, in effect, this: if a mother has a child and the child is severely handicapped, is infanticide allowed? And he says, well, possibly if you just look at this child, it may be that with proper care and considering the joy that the parents have in this child, it's better to let it live, because there's more pleasure on balance, more happiness on balance than pain. But then he says, now consider, suppose that child would prevent the mother from ever having another child. It's too costly, the resources that go into taking care of this child are just huge, and therefore the mother will never have another one. Whereas if the child is killed, then the mother will have the time and the resources to have another child. Then all of a sudden, Singer says, you are comparing a perfectly healthy child and the happiness that brings into the world and the pleasure that brings into the world with the imperfect, handicapped child. And he says clearly in that case, infanticide is permissible, even perhaps obligatory. So you see, the whole argument there rides on the fact that the handicapped child is replaceable by another human person who represents the species more perfectly. Almost makes one cry. But I bring this up to again try to bring home this sense that we know this is wrong. Why is this wrong? Because persons are incommunicably their own. They can't simply be replaced by another human being. Also in Katie's courtship course, this featured pretty prominently, that a man who simply wants a wife that does the cooking and the cleaning and maybe provides some pleasant conversation in the evening is not really doing justice to the fact that this wife is also a person. You have to value the spouse, the person you fall in love with, and you do, if you're truly in love, value the person for who he or she is, most essentially, and you appreciate the values, the talents, the skills, all the other qualities, only in relation to this individual personhood. of the one you love. So there too, this reducing persons to a list of qualities is an instance of overlooking their incommunicable being. Again, think of God now. Try to imagine the absoluteness of this truth. God calls us by name. That's a very central idea in Christianity. He asks each of us, just like he asks Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" I don't care what the others say. I want to know what you think about me, how you relate to me. Or think of God's faithfulness. Why is it that he still bothers about me? Why doesn't he get another Dutchman, equally handsome? Hard to imagine.
Yeah.
I know. But why? I mean, I mess up so frequently. Why does he die for me? Why not just replace me with another one? Why? Because he cares about me, not about the Dutchman, not about my beauty, not about my eloquence, but rather about me as an individual. All right. So there's something very moving about this faithfulness in God. Again and again, he leaves the 99, he goes for the one. Why? Because, I mean, it seems to me a very eloquent witness to the incommunicability of the person and the fact that God also respects it and cares about it. All right, fourth, this is the last way of putting, again, what's basically one and the same truth about the person, namely that each person belongs to himself and not to any other. Now, that's obvious in the slavery example. That doesn't require much reasoning, much arguing. The fact that a slave is considered to be the property of another person is an obvious violation of this self-mastery, self-ownership of persons. A person owns himself. He has been handed, you could say, governance over his own life. He has been both given the task and challenged to determine his own life, to take charge of his own destiny, to be, as Wojtyła says, the or is it you who says this?
Either me or Wojtyła. I always get a
he has to be the protagonist of his own, of the drama of his own existence. Is that you?
I quote him a lot, saying.
So, person belongs to himself. Now, let me talk a little bit about a tangent that Crosby goes into here, and that is of the person as a subject of rights. It belongs with this idea that persons belong to themselves, are their own master. Crosby says that this makes sense of why it is that persons are subjects of rights and non-persons are not subject of rights. He thinks that the violation of a right can be understood as the theft against the being of a person. A theft, that means to say the person belongs to himself, and in violating a right, I take that which belongs to him. I make use of it without his permission. I somehow violate his prerogatives, things that are given to him to do or decide, I do or decide for him. So if the violation of a right is the usurpation of something that belongs to the other person. That's why, Crosby argues, you can't really violate the right of yourself, but only the right of another person. So if you think of the prostitute degrades herself, that we've already said, but she doesn't really violate her own rights. Why? Because you can't steal from your own wallet. You can't commit theft against your own being. You can violate your own dignity, which shows that dignity is a much deeper concept. Dignity is prior to and the foundation of rights, which is why, this is overlooked, I think, by much of the rights language nowadays, as if rights are sort of the final thing, the ultimate test. This is what's overlooked in any ethics that makes mutual consent the last and final test of whether it's right or wrong. Again, to look at the prostitution case, we all know that both the client and the prostitute degrade themselves, and yet there's mutual consent. There's no rights violation going on, and yet we all know, at least most of us know, that this is deeply wrong, deeply degrading, deeply unethical. So, well, to me at least, this little tangent both sheds light on what we mean by self-ownership and also sheds a lot of light on what rights are, why animals don't have rights. I think many people are confused about that. We ought to take care of people. We can't just be cruel to them also. But it is not because they have rights that must be respected. It's because they have a certain value, because it's cruel to make them suffer when they can feel suffering and so on. So it sheds a lot of light, I think, both on the nature of rights, how it is related to the person, and why rights are secondary to dignity, a result of dignity, a consequence of dignity. If you give up on dignity, you might as well forget about rights. And of course, this happens all over the place. You can't maintain rights without maintaining dignity. This is why people who want to replace dignity, they think dignity is too vague, it's a useless concept, let's talk about rights only. They're not just mistaken, they're, I think, badly undermining their own insistence on rights. Okay, so four aspects. Persons are ends in themselves, never mere means. Persons are wholes of themselves and never mere parts. Persons are incommunicably their own, never mere specimen, mere types, and persons belong to themselves and can't be the property of another. Those are the four, and as Crosby argues, in the end, really they all go towards one truth about the person, which could be expressed this way. He says it is about the selfhood and solitude of the person, or his favorite classical definition of the person is a Latin one, a Roman one, persona est sui juris et alteri incommunicabilis, which means that a person is a being of its own and does not share its being with another. All of that sort of sums up the four things we mentioned.